Welcome to Pop Rocket, our weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. I'm Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum this week, who is off, I think, professionally ogling Olympic athletes. We're also missing Margaret Wappler, who is still on her fabulous Neon Green book tour, and therefore, holding it down with me this week to talk all things pop culture is our loyal digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello.
Hello, Winter. Looking fabulous in your dime piece outfit.
Thank you.
We need to have... this is why we take a photograph, just so people of our show every week.
I haven't seen a photograph in a minute, Christian.
It's only on the Max Fun page. They never share it with the rest of us.
Don't you know Webb is dead?
We have not one, but two special guests.
Yeah.
Of course, we have editor-in-chief of Birth, Movies, Death, and the co-host of the Canon podcast, Devin Ferrucci.
Farachi.
Close enough. Very close.
Farachi.
I've heard worse, trust me.
Can you just briefly explain the concept behind The Canon?
Sure. The Canon is a show where myself and Amy Nicholson, the chief film critic at MTV, get together and we debate about which movies belong in the canon of all-time greats to live on forever. And at the end of every single episode, after we've made our arguments, we open it up to the listeners and they vote and they make the final decision.
So
it's
what,
democracy in action.
What is under consideration this week?
Right now, A Hard Day's Night, the 1963 Richard Lester Beatles movie, is currently up for vote.
Did you make an argument for or against it?
Oh, I love it. Oh, okay. My God. Look at me. I'm an old man.
Stop.
So, inclusion in that case. And Birth, Movies, and Death, I assume, is a website about movies.
It is. It's about, we believe
no, it's
that,
about birth.
We believe that there are three things we must all experience: birth, movies, and death. And so that's our philosophy. We're a website. We also publish special commemorative magazines for some of the more exciting and interesting movies that come out every single year. We have one about Star Trek right now on sale coming up in September, one about Tim Burton.
Very cool.
Cool.
All right. Thank you for joining us. And we are also joined by our old friend, comedian and writer Riley Silverman.
Hello.
How you been?
I've been good. I think I realized it as I was sitting down that I don't think I've ever been in a room with all four Pop Rocket, like, core cast. And it makes sense on the show because I wouldn't be here if you were. But, like, I remember at Max FunCon, like, the three of you were there, but Oliver, you weren't there because you were...
I was on the East Coast, unfortunately.
Yeah. I thought maybe it was one of those things where when the entire Pop Rocket crew is in one location, like, one person has to stay separate in case it's, like, an attack of some sort.
That's the premise of the new Kiefer Sutherland TV
show.
Exactly. I'm sitting somewhere underneath, like, a thousand feet of concrete with a football, a nuclear football by my side.
Getting
just in
too
case
old for this shit.
Some shit goes down.
So he's sitting somewhere with a list of pop culture topics to go over in case the rest of the crew is dead. You got like winner's notes. Devin, I'm curious because you were bringing up, what's the movie that you were the most annoyed that people voted into the canon that you didn't think should be?
Ooh, good question.
I don't think, Working Girl.
Oh.
That was actually easier than I thought.
Get out.
It's fine. It's just
that's
not
my favorite movie.
It's just not one of the greatest movies of all time. It's
OMG.
Fine.
Okay. Muzzle
Devin,
on
Devin
you.
Just brought a knife to a gunfight.
He has like a 10-second penalty like League of Legends. 10-second timeout.
All right. Coming up on this week's show, we conduct a Pop Rocket postmortem on the summer blockbuster season, plus our usual assortment of musical jams. But first, let's find out what we've all been about this week in the world of pop. Devin, let's start off with you.
I am all about Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. The show officially opened on the West End, and the special rehearsal edition script was released so that all of us who cannot make it to the UK can actually follow along with the 8th and supposedly final Harry Potter adventure. It's really freaking Harry Potter fans out. They're real upset about it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Summarize, what is the freak out about?
I loved it.
Well, the freak out is, it's minor spoiler territory, but one thing, Harry Potter's a bad dad, turns out. In fact, tells his son, Albus Severus Potter, I wish you weren't my son sometimes. tough stuff. There's the question of whether or not Voldemort ever went down to Bone Town and had a baby. And that's really upsetting Potter fans who think that Voldemort... There were a couple,
can reproduce?
Well, there's a couple who were mad at me and was like, Voldemort's never been in love. And I was like, I have some really important information to share with you about baby making.
Yeah.
Some very important information.
Oh, my goodness.
Because if that's your birth control, you're in a lot of fucking trouble.
Oh, my God.
So that was they're upset about that and a couple of other sort of little things that are... You know, because the Potter characters are older. And some of them aren't as happy or, you know, as, like, doing as well as you might want them to. And I think that's
where drama comes from.
It's drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I loved it. I adored it. I thought it's a beautiful look at legacy. I think it's a beautiful look at parents and children. And I think it really ties up the entire Harry Potter saga in a beautiful way.
So given that this is not a formal novel, right? Mm-hmm. It's a script, number one. Given that it is a big jump in time in terms of, I mean, what's it, 20 years into the future?
It's actually present day.
No, but I mean from the last film.
Like, because what people don't realize is that the Harry Potter books all take place in the past.
Right.
Harry was born in 1980. So all the books take place in the 90s, so they're all listening to Pearl Jam the entire time.
Not enough New Wave during the original movies. They really missed opportunity there.
It's all Muggle stuff, man.
People who are fans of the original books, do they really need to mess with this new one? Or should they just protect themselves in their little bubble of the first seven books, I guess?
As someone who's a fan of the first books, as someone who got in when Prisoner of Azkaban came out, like, you know, in America, I think this is a wonderful conclusion. I think it really, as, you know, Rowling aged up the books, you know, every year as the readers aged.
Right.
And this one ages up to middle age. It's about a middle-aged character, and it's got a lot of middle-aged themes. And so I understand if some younger readers have a hard time with that. But for me, I found it really, really profound, actually.
Cool.
Really beautiful.
Well, and I feel like there's enough of the kids in it for the people who are younger, too.
I agree.
Like, there's definitely enough kids. I loved it, too. Like, we actually did it as a reading the night it came out. And we, like, assigned parts and sat around reading it.
Oh, wow.
And I do think that anyone who's, like, interested in trying it who might be apprehensive about it for, like, the reasons that you kind of went through, I think if you read it as a group or, like, read it with people out loud, I think it plays a lot better if you than just sitting down and reading it as a book.
Because
I read part of it with the group, and then I read the rest of it on my own, but still having everyone's voices in my head as I read it on my own, and I think it really helped.
Yeah, that's, like, leveled up for super fans.
Well, the new kids are really incredible. I think Scorpius Malfoy, Malfoy's son, is incredible. He's maybe, like, one of my favorite Harry Potter characters ever.
I mean, I'm a Slytherin for life, so for me, this was like my jam of a book. So, yeah.
Do you have plans to try to go see the actual play?
You know what? I would love to. If fate and circumstance allows, I would totally do it.
You've been in London like twice in the last
three times in the last year. But, you know, it's just that show sold out. It's like Hamilton. That show's just sold out. So you can maybe luck into it, but, like, I'm not really making plans.
You're not trying to stub-hub your way up in there.
Mm-hmm. No. This is one of those times where I'm always like, is this the thing that I do a GoFundMe for? Is this the one? Do I fundraise that people can send me for my own personal edification?
I'm not saying put
if that
punch
works,
in
let
on
me know,
that one. Yeah, exactly. Jesus Christ.
Riley, what are you all about this week?
I am all about... Well, I was going to be all about that, but since we already did that, I am all about Don't Think Twice, the new film of Mike Birbiglia and Ira Glass as
fabulous.
Well.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, I was a really big fan of Mike's first film, Sleepwalk With Me, based on his one-man show, and this was like a nice... It's an interesting bookend to that movie because it's a kind of a... Not unlike the way the Harry Potter stuff is, where it's like, mm-hmm. this is a younger vision and this is an older vision. Mm-hmm. It's about an improv group in New York, and then one of the members, played by Keegan-Michael Key, his character's name is Jack, gets cast on like a SNL surrogate called Weekend Live. And it's all about like the way the group responds to that, and it's all about like... Also, like, the theater the group is doing improv in is closing, and so it's kind of like the end of this era.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, everyone in the movie, all the characters are in their mid-30s, and they've all been pushing this dream for a long time. And except for Jack, none of them have really made it yet. And so it's all about, like, the sacrifices you make as a person to mm-hmm. chase a dream for an extended period of time, and the weight that it has on your soul, and what it does to your overall life and your relationships, and it's... As a comedian in her 30s, it was a hard movie to sit through. It was like, but it was really, really good. And I think between these two films, Biglia, I think, has just made some of, like, it's so hard for the life of a comedian to be captured on film, I feel like. And maybe every job is that way, and I just know it because I'm a comic.
Yeah.
But I feel like these are, like, two of the best movies I've ever seen as far as really capturing the essence of what it is to exist in this world.
He was on NPR today, and he was talking about putting the movie together and why the movies came together, because he did a show for TBS that didn't go to wasn't ordered to series, and how it propelled him forward to make the film. And then he was talking about what this film in particular talks about, what success means to different people, because he thought he wanted something that it was going to propel him forward to something else.
Yeah.
And then in having that failure and accepting that failure, he got into this situation with these films, so I want to see it.
So I haven't seen either. Are these done more sort of quasi realistic, mm-hmm. or more in the Christopher Guest satirical over the top way?
Yeah.
Closer realistic than they are the Guest thing. Sleepwalk With Me is a little bit more fourth wall breaking because it basically was a one man show that he turned into a film.
Got
he dresses at the camera a lot and talks to it. He's playing a fictional version of himself,
right.
But basically, both films just take what's like a real life experience and then condense it down into a shorter period of time. And so, to make it lend itself to film very well. So it's like a. Then the first movie, he actually. Another thing about Sleepwalk with Me is he actually suffered from like a chronic sleepwalking condition that was like he had these crazy adventures that would happen because he was sleepwalking. And luckily, Mike Birbiglia happens to be an extremely gifted storyteller and taught like that's one of his comedic gifts.
Right, yeah.
So he was able to take these like ridiculous events that were happening to him and take them to the stage, and then they translated well to film as well. Yeah. But overlapping the sleepwalking story is this like comedian who's like getting his first taste of like road gigs and like. Basically steals his parents' car or whatever, like drives around like upstate New York for like a month and just like does like cheap gigs and like makes enough money to get to the next gig. And that's what that life was like. So
that's cool.
Is there a Lorne Michaels doppelganger?
There is. There is a guy.
Played by who?
I forget his name on top of my head. He's a character actor. Okay. And I know him, but yeah, his name is like Tim Easton or something like that in the movie. And he's definitely later. There's a couple scenes because the idea is too with the character of Jack who makes it on Weekend Live. It's not like he's suddenly this like perfect star. SNL is a really tough gig,
yeah.
And so you see a lot of the struggle he has with it. So,
yeah,
I saw the movie last Thursday. It was in limited release, and I drove 40 minutes across town to go see it, and then it opened up in the theater 5 minutes from my house the next day.
That's amazing. Of course.
Why you got to check next day on Fandango. Yeah. Always go to the next day on Fandango.
But, you know, I wouldn't have had a chance to see it if I hadn't gone that night anyway, so it worked out. But it's, like, stuck with me. Like, I can't – every day I think about it again, and it's, like – it's really it was a tough movie to watch, but it's really really good. It has some really funny moments, and the cast is incredible. Everybody in it is really good. It's got like Gillian Jacobs from Community, mm-hmm. Kate Micucci, who I love, is one of the members of the group, Chris Gethard, and Tammy Seger. So it's like this group of people who kind of all themselves are known for kind of having forged their own path, and now they're playing this group that's
Right. All right. The film is Don't Think Twice.
Yeah.
I'm all about the Olympics this week. And the caveats here is I realize the IOC is a terribly corrupt organization.
Wow, they are.
The Olympics are usually really, really bad for the host city, especially Rio. I do not want LA to win its 2024 bid.
The beauty shots of Rio don't even look appealing. The place looks like it's under siege.
It's not like Rio was like the best city in the world before this happened. Ooh, too.
Well,
they
wasn't.
Can stop killing trans people, and then they can hear me talk nice about
Riley,
them.
Riley, there's so many horrible things happening there. Let's not open that Pandora's box with that.
So with
put dynamite on top of it.
Sorry.
With all that being
prostitution.
Said,
it's a lot of murders. It's a lot of murders.
I'm still a fan of the Olympics. Thank God it's only once every 4 years.
Yeah.
Because then you can sort of build up a tolerance to everything else around it.
Yeah.
But for those 2 weeks, I just love watching stuff that I sat through the women's seven rugby final today between Australia North and New Zealand. That was fantastic.
Yeah.
But my favorite sport in week one is team archery. And I discovered this back in 2012. I was 1,000% ready for it this year. It's already concluded. You should check for it in 2020. But the thing about team archery is even though as a sport, it's not necessarily that visually appealing.
Right.
But there is a built-in narrative with every time someone shoots the arrow because you don't know where it's going to land. And because it's a team sport, the first two people might, you know, they basically might hit a 10, basically the bullseye effectively.
Yeah.
But then that third person, and this happened to the Italian women's team in the semifinals, and it was a horrible but majestic thing to see, completely shanked it and basically shot her team out of the semifinals.
No.
So it's people have been making fun of me on the Facebook group about it.
Oh, yes.
Team archery in the Olympics
is
incredible. You should all get with it. And I'm sure by this time next week, I will have found some other relatively obscure sport by American pro sport standards to go gaga over. What I really wanted to talk about was the Parade of Nations fashions.
Yeah.
I feel bad not doing it without Guy here because I know he's got some feelings about it.
I mean, literally, that's pretty much the only thing I watched.
To watch for the opening ceremony.
Sorry. I just remember Russia was so terrible. What, Russia was Winter Olympics, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The Sochi Olympics.
So the Sochi Olympics, just like that opening ceremony was such a clusterfuck that I was like swearing off because LA 84 was so amazing. I mean, it was like Lionel Richie and fireworks and running through the streets of Los Angeles. I mean, it was just so amazing. But the only thing that I watched was Giselle strutting across. I mean, that was a strut for your life. She strutted her
fame,
ass
Hall of fame
off.
Strut
that
right
is the
there.
Number one strut.
That goes in the canon.
And it goes in the, that's
that goes
a canon
the canon
strut,
that's
okay?
A canon strut.
She worked the shit out of that stage. God damn.
I was a big fan of the London with the Danny Boyle directed London ones. Those ones
that
were
was beautiful,
a little surreal, but yeah,
it was like
that was the
Circus
Spice Girls,
right?
Yeah, like the weird, like the whole like trip through children's literature.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And like
yes.
The, yeah, the thousand Mary Poppins floating
Woo!
Down. I mean, it's a good spectacle, but I'm just there. I'm there to see what nation states come with it fashion wise.
I can't wait for Qatar.
You know, and again, maybe if Guy's back with us next week, we can talk about it. Maybe
yeah.
We can harken back to that.
Sure.
Winner, what are you all about this week?
Oh, okay. So I watched DJ AM. DJ AM, for people who don't know, was this amazing DJ in Los Angeles. He was from Philly, but got his roots in LA during like being a teenager in the mid 80s and well into the 90s. He played all of sort of the biggest clubs and followed the tide of club culture going from like this sort of things you only heard about, but with the emergence of internet culture, it started to, and tabloid culture exploded onto the pages for people to be obsessed with. And he was one of the preeminent DJs in Los Angeles. He started he didn't start it, okay? You can correct me, Oliver, but he did sort of coined this way of mixing music where he would mash up, you know, older classic rock songs with hip hop or classic R&B. And he was, you know, he kind of helped bring hip hop back to club culture because it was overtaken by EDM so ferociously. He had a crazy life sort of once he became that famous. And he was also a real committed drug addict until he got sober and lost a ton of weight. But then he got into a plane crash with Travis Barker while they were touring. And then he started taking drugs again. And he unfortunately died of an overdose. But that's not to leave it on that sad note. I mean, the documentary...
What's it called, first of all?
As I Am. And it's not so much about his life, which was short and tragic. It's more about the music. And I started listening to a lot of his mixtapes, which you can find on SoundCloud easily. His mixtapes are some of the best things to just throw on in the middle of a party or start a party with. And they're all labeled by the set he was DJing for. So there's like Lindsay Lohan birthday party 2006. There's like Paris Hilton's like, you know, 22nd birthday party. Party 2002, whatever, and it just, you know, LAX night, whatever, and it's really good to hear. It really reminds me of like the mid-aughts when things were just really fun, and I was in my 20s, and it was all about partying and like hanging out with celebrities, and then freaking 2009, pop culture died.
Okay,
100%.
That's not a down note at all. All yeah. Right, awesome.
That's why we're here for you, pulling it up from the dredges by its bootstraps.
Is this in theaters right now?
It is not on theaters. It's on Showtime and okay. On demand.
Okay, great. And it's called As I AM.
As I AM.
All right, very clever. All right, you, dear listener, are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk summer blockbusters after this.
I'm Allegra Ringo.
And I'm Renee Colbert. And we host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog?
Renee, can I tell you about a dog I met this week?
I wish that you would. In turn, though, can I tell you about a dog hero?
May I tell you about a dog breed in a segment I like to call Mutt Minute?
I would love that. Could we maybe talk about some dog tech?
Could we have some cool guests on, like Lin-Manuel Miranda, Nicole Byer, and Ann Wheaton?
I mean... Yeah, absolutely.
I'm in.
You're on board? What do you say we do all of this and put it into a podcast?
Yeah, okay.
You think? Right. Should we call it, like, I don't know, Can I Pet Your Dog?
Sure.
All right. What do you say we put it on every Tuesday on Maximum Fun?
Or on iTunes. Sounds good to me.
Meeting's over.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum. And with me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Devin Faranci.
Riley Silverman.
So this past weekend represented the last of the major tentpole films to open this summer, which was Suicide Squad, which seems to follow a very familiar pattern of very big opening weekend numbers, but yet critically decimated. And it also seems to fit into a general narrative about the summer of 2016 being a very bad movie, a bad year for movies, at least for blockbusters. I guess one question I wanted to start with here is that if last summer was a record-breaking summer, in other words, it set box office records, and this summer falls short of that, is that really a disappointment? Isn't that just a return to the mean? I guess I'll throw it to you on this one, Devin.
I mean, I feel like the movie sucked so bad this summer that it is, by any definition, a disappointment.
So it's not even the box office. The quality of the films has been so poor.
Yeah, this is just one of those summers where it just feels like you don't even want to go to the movies. Like, and that's like,
yeah. Clearly,
that's,
maybe that's
really
what's happened.
Is.
I've had a few free evenings. I don't usually because of stand-up, and I'll go see a movie, and then I like open up Fandango, right. And I'm like, I don't want to see anything now.
Right, and in the summer, usually you're pretty willing to go see some real garbage because it's like air conditioned, and you're like, oh, you know, it's all right.
Yeah.
But this summer has been, has been brutal this summer. And as somebody who professionally watches movies, this has been like the summer of my discontent.
Nightmarish.
Yeah, this has been real bad.
We're going to come back to that point, but let's first start with Suicide Squad, and half the people in the room have actually seen the film. And what did you think of it?
It's like an order of nachos when you've had like four margaritas. You're like, you know it's going to be good, or it might be kind of crap, but I'm just, you need something to coat your stomach. And it's like a mixed, it's all messy and mixed up and weird and different colors. And then you eat it and then you're like, you know what? I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did it because now I know.
Devin?
It's a total mess. You can really see all the reshoots and all the studio notes in it. But the cast is good. There are some pretty good characters in it that I enjoyed. It doesn't make any sense. And the thing I said in my review, the movie's so clearly aping Guardians of the Galaxy that if Guardians of the Galaxy were Coca-Cola, Suicide Squad is Faygo. So that's sort of, I think, where the sums of it.
Faygo!
This, you know,
it
this
does
is,
seem like it would appeal to juggalos.
It's real juggalo heavy. Yeah, yeah.
So that's one segment that you can count on. We'll
Margot Robbie is great.
Yeah, whoop whoop to all my ninjas out there. Yeah, definitely.
Margot Robbie is great. Will Smith is, you know, serviceable, and
I liked Will Smith in it.
I liked him, but I mean, I felt like Jared Leto, like jump off a bridge, and there's, you know, so many other people that are underused or not utilized, and then the whole. I'm flummoxed by Viola Davis. What's her motivation here? So, yes.
I like Viola Davis, too. She's a total badass. In a movie that's about supervillains,
sure.
She's the scariest one, and she's like the government operative who's in control
and
of it.
She's wearing, like, INC by Macy's the entire time.
Given that this is the second major film out of DC Comics, the first one obviously being Batman versus Superman, that has been critically, critically panned, I think it's created this... To me, a bit of an instant narrative that DC can't figure out, or maybe Warner Brothers can't figure out how to make a good movie about DC. True or false?
I think it's a false. I don't think it's an instant narrative. I think this has been the narrative all along, and I think you've pointed out they've kind of course corrected a little bit for Justice League, but up until now they haven't, and they've keep putting out these stories about how like everyone in the room applauded when we test screened it. I'm like, that's like also a room that none of us were in, and we can't talk to anybody who saw it.
Where people got to see it for free,
and it's, right. Well, no, it was all executives.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
was also like the guys who get really excited are the guys who count the money.
Exactly. I can see what toys will sell from
exactly.
this. Yeah, it's like every the second. They announced Batman versus Superman at Comic-Con a couple years ago. I was like, this is going to be a mess. And then the Suicide Squad was coming out, too. I'm like, you guys don't know what you're doing yet.
Yeah.
Like, it's so frustrating.
When you say you guys don't know what you're doing, who is you guys here?
I think whoever's, like, the WBDC team who's in charge of, the like, this actual film family.
Okay.
I can name names.
Yeah, please Woo! Do. Yeah.
And it's Zack Snyder, Charles Roven, Debbie Snyder, and Kevin Tsujihara. Kevin Tsujihara is a guy that used to run amusement parks, and they made him the head of Warner Brothers.
Oh, there.
And he doesn't have any real movie experience, and he's not particularly great.
He's a little bit of a star fucker.
Zack Snyder is a disaster. Charles Roven is a great producer, but his job is to be a body man, which is to let Zack Snyder make his terrible movies.
Yeah, Zack has, I think, taken a lot of the heat around this. Whether fair or not, it sounds like partially fair, simply because he's perhaps the best known single name associated with it. Is it time for Warner Brothers and DC to cut bait with Zack? Would that even happen given the current regime?
They already did.
Oh, they did?
Oh, yeah. This is Justice League as it's over after that.
You know what, though? Here's the thing, is that he made Watchmen, and I liked Watchmen until the Leonard Cohen sex scene with inside the whatever the thing was supposed to be.
Hallelujah plays.
The Hallelujah.
In the owl ship.
In the owl ship.
Oh, the owl ship, yeah.
And then I was like, but you know what? Visually, you know, it's a compelling look. I like what he's done with it. I don't want to put all the blame on him. There's special effects issues in Suicide Squad. Things don't look rushed. They look like the studio put their hand in it.
Sure did.
And those are the parts that stuck out to me more than anything.
Well, what I'll say about what you said about Zack Snyder is that the movies that he does that people like or remember liking are all movies where he kind of just took somebody else's story and just shot it. Like his Dawn of the Dead remake is a James Gunn movie.
And
it is a James Gunn movie.
I love that movie.
The Watchmen, for the most part, is word for word the book and just a different ending that's just made for tightening. And 300 is just a Frank Miller graphic novel.
Right.
And the problem is that somewhere along the line, Zack decided he was a great, like he started getting touted as this visionary filmmaker.
Right.
I'm like, you're not a visionary if you're just taking somebody else's visuals and putting them on screen.
But,
But I think when he's in charge of story, I think is where he just has no ability to make it work.
Dawn of the Dead, there's one note that I remember him talking about when he was making Dawn of the Dead that I will never forget that I thought was really cool. And that's as you watch the film, it slowly degrades. And I always thought that that was just something wrong with my TV or my copy because I downloaded it off the internet. But then when he explained that he purposely made it super bright in the beginning and then by the end of the movie you can barely see what's going on, I thought that was like, that had to be all him.
And that's kind of stuff I give him credit for. Like, his visuals are great, but he just, like, he's not good at actually telling the story that he wants to visualize.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, I'm going to say this, and I get a lot of crap for this. I think he's actually a great filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I think that he just needs the right script. I think he cannot be in charge of the script of the development process.
And he needs a break.
He needs to come in. He needs to be able to, he has, his visual style is unreal. I watched 300. It is an unreal looking movie. I even like Sucker Punch. I'm even
on
the
Sucker
record.
Punch too.
I like Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
But he needs somebody else's script, and he needs to not be involved in the development.
True.
So Suicide Squad did really, really good numbers this past weekend, broke all kinds of records for a movie opening in August, even better than Guardians of the Galaxy from last summer. And it also overperformed with Black and Latino audiences. Why do we think that is?
Because I will just, as the one of the ethnic people in here,
thank
Devin,
you.
Do you count?
I'm Sicilian. I don't know. Okay. You tell me.
No. Italians have gotten past the
Moorish is too far back in there, that lineage.
Deep, deep Moorish, yeah.
Watching the
privilege
movie.
Privilege roulette would definitely not stop.
Really? No, I noticed immediately. I said, this is a very colored movie. And it's from the music choice. It's from the type of lingo that is used, the different musical cues. You know, it's heavy with the Will Smith. You know, J. Rodriguez is actually on that other show where he fixes people, him and all the other gay boys fix people's lives. J. Hernandez, his whole backstory there, and it felt like there was a lot of diversity in the film, so I can see how maybe the MRAs of the world, the Trump voters, would be annoyed by the idea that there was a lot more emphasis placed on women, having the boss, the person directing everybody being Viola Davis, who is a dark, chocolatey, older Black woman. I can see how this would appeal to African Americans, Latinos, because we're comfortable seeing these positions of power and different types of volatile types on screen. I can see how it would make others uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I just think you put Will Smith in a movie and you're going to definitely motivate a certain audience because he's the biggest movie star that exists right now. Him and Tom Cruise, I think they're the only two remaining movie stars.
When's the last time Will Smith had a really, carried
this
a box
weekend.
Office?
This weekend.
This past
Ooh!
Weekend.
Okay. Duly burned.
So I think that, but I think he also has like a very loyal audience. I think that that's a big part of it. I think it's great. And I think, I do think that David Ayer, for whatever reason, he keeps making movies that are set like in like the Hispanic community, a number of them now. Mm. And I think he might've picked up an audience along the way as well.
I think that's what made Fast and the Furious films really last the way they have. Right. I think that the diversity of talent represented in it makes a large community want to come out and see it.
Yeah.
And it also happens to be, they're very exciting, fun movies to watch. Yeah. And I do think in the case of Suicide Squad too, I think you can't factor out the train wreck crowd too. I think that I saw Batman vs Superman because I knew it was going to be a disaster, kind of. And then I also love Batman, but
given the train wreck impulse, or maybe I guess going against that, the predictions are because the reviews were so bad that despite the record setting opening weekend, they expect something like a 60%+ drop off by next weekend. And I guess I was reading that 60% is considered really bad. If it's less than 40, that's really good.
Less than 40 is phenomenal. Like, so, if you get a less than 40% drop off
in
2016, you're Avatar.
So Devin, I think maybe you're the person to ask this. How does a movie studio read the leaves on this? If you have a record setting opening weekend, but then the thing just drops off a cliff the next weekend, is that a success? Is it not a success?
No, it's not a success. Suicide. Here's the thing: is that this same thing happened to Batman Superman. The problem is that box office is a long game in some ways, so you need to have multiple weekends to really make your money back. The way that you look at how a movie makes its money is you look at the budget of the movie, double that's what it has to make to break even.
Right.
So at the rate of dropping off 60% week to week, it's not going to end up breaking even. It's not, the movie isn't going to open in China, which is a big money maker. China is not accepting it.
I just read that.
They didn't Ghostbusters either, right? That was also
something. No, Ghostbusters had ghosts in it, so you cannot play in China. It's a thing.
My people, weird like that.
It was ghosts was what kept it. I mean, like, right. So the entire premise of Ghostbusters kept that movie out of the country.
China is afraid of some ghosts.
They are.
Should I go? Should I leave?
Yes, that's my waitress.
Riley will never be allowed into China for that joke.
But a second week drop off that big, you know, indicates also the audience didn't like it that much.
Right.
And that's the real killer in the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not just the math of it. It's the idea that the audience is telling people, don't bother.
I want to shift to talking about the broader summer blockbuster season in just a moment. But one last thing about Suicide Squad, and I think we've touched a little bit on this already, is that I think that one of the things that's been, again, one of the narratives that's been created around the lack of success with Suicide Squad and DC as a whole is that somehow DC has not managed its catalog as well as Marvel has.
Right.
And there's a really good debate that broke out in the Pop Rocket Face group about this. And some people are arguing, well, partially it's because Marvel just has better source material and therefore it's easier to make better stuff with it. So, Riley, you disagree with this argument.
Very much so.
Okay, go in.
I think that DC has the two most iconic characters in comic books. So you have your Batman, you have your Superman. And I think that what Marvel did with their films, you can't tell me that those characters are less strong source material than Iron Man or Thor or Ant-Man. But I think what Marvel did that was so smart was when they first started, when it was just, Marvel was their own studio, they weren't bought by Disney yet, and they were just like, okay, we're tired of seeing our films be sent off to other studios that are going to ruin them.
Fantastic Four.
Yeah, exactly. And they were like, they wanted to make the money off of themselves, and they made Marvel Studios. They started small. They made Iron Man, and then they made the Hulk, which didn't do that great.
Right,
and I've noticed they haven't made another Hulk movie since then. They're going to put him in other movies, his own.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so same thing with when you got your Captain America, First Avenger, you have Thor. They slowly built it. Each movie too, they also brought on a director who knew what they were doing and kind of like trusted them with what they were doing. Until then, eventually they got a little more.
And they did something that's interesting. It's funny you bring that up. Robert Downey Jr. was not a star at that point, really.
He was kind of coming back.
He was
low at that point.
Like, he was Sherlock Holmes, and that was about it.
Sherlock Holmes even happened yet. He could not get he could not get insured for Iron Man.
Exactly.
They had to pony up extra money for him because he had been such a drug addict that he could not get insured.
Right.
Wasn't that the issue with part of why Terrence Howard didn't come back? Because he actually made more on Iron Man than Downey Jr. did, and then he wanted more for the sequel. And like, well, we're not going to bring you back then. Like,
started the whole thing.
Nobody likes him, I think, is the other problem.
Yeah, that's yeah. Nobody. He's a gigantic asshole who likes baby wipes.
And then
it's hard out here for a
minute. He loves
really
baby wipes.
Loves baby wipes. But then,
it took years to get from Iron Man to Avengers.
Like Ed Norton
and
was
even
the
Avengers
first Hulk, right?
Yeah.
Like Ed Norton. What do you think Ed Norton got paid to be the Hulk?
Those guys got paid nothing those days. They got paid nothing. And they were locked into 6-picture deals, 9-picture deals.
Yeah.
I think the big difference is. I think Marvel likes their characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you watch Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman, Zack Snyder doesn't like Superman.
Mm-mm.
Like, you watch these movies are about Zack Snyder saying, why would Superman help people?
Right.
Yeah.
And so Zack Snyder's dream project is to make an Ayn Rand movie. So when you, and that's true. So
right.
when you
oh,
realize
right.
that,
right. Yes.
when you realize that,
yeah.
you're like, oh, of course this guy doesn't understand a superhero whose whole thing is being selfless. He doesn't.
Yeah.
So both Man of Steel and BVS are basically examinations of, why the fuck would this guy help people?
Yeah.
That's both of them are actually trying to understand it. So Marvel loves their characters. DC has not yet found the filmmakers who love these characters.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that with that argument that Marvel somehow has managed its catalog better, there have been a lot of not great Marvel films. I think we sort of forget that in contrast to the ones that are really, really good.
There's not a single, every single Marvel film is fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Every single one.
Really?
And every single...
Even Iron Man 3?
I love Iron Man 3. And yes,
I do, too.
I love
Iron Man 3. It's unfairly maligned.
It's unfairly
maligned.
I'm not even blinded by the Audi sponsorship in that.
But yes, even Thor 2, which I think is their worst one, every single one is fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. So yeah.
Is kind of amazing when you look at it. There's like up to 14 of them now.
They almost feel like the Marvel films at this point feel like a really... And I'm not the first one to make the comparison. I'm not a genius. But like, it's a long-running, stretched-out, expensive TV series. And so the episodes that don't... The movies that don't like hit the mark as high as like say the first Avengers or the Iron Man movies or whatever, like they're like just like, yeah, it's fine, yeah, it's good to see that guy again, and then we're gonna like, at this point the Marvel brand is so strong that like, and like, you know, I brought up James Gunn earlier, when Guardians of the Galaxy was on its way due out in theaters, I heard a lot of like like early whiffs of like, oh, this is going to be terrible. Not based on any reviews or anything, just like because no one knew the characters and it seemed so weird. But because on the strength of like they knew who they hired to do it, they knew he had a good voice for this thing. They knew Nicole, is it Perlman?
Perlman, yeah.
Yeah, she was. They knew they had a solid writer to work with him to make sure they were like in tone with the rest of the films. And so it was a great movie, and it was fun to watch.
It knocked Iron Man from my number one.
I think it might be my favorite of the Marvel ones, too.
Yeah.
Should we feel at all hopeful for Justice League and or Wonder Woman?
No.
I mean, I had this. The trailers kind of got me excited, even though I should
Wonder
know
Woman,
better.
Wonder Woman, yes, but Justice League,
because
no.
It's because of the Snyder touch.
I mean, I've been on the set of Justice League.
Go on.
And I think they get what they fucked up.
Ooh.
The problem is that Justice League went into production right after BVS came out. So can they adjust it? Wonder Woman, I've talked to people who were involved and people who have read the script and people who have seen early cuts. And the word that I've heard is that it's really good. And that it's not just really good, it's super hopeful.
It kind of
which has been the thing. Yeah, the thing that you don't have in these DC films have not been hopeful. Mm-hmm. The things you go to a Marvel movie and you walk out feeling like happy and recharged.
Yeah.
You walk out of
Batman,
Superman.
Even when they fought each other for an entire movie, you're still like, they're all doing pretty good at the end of it.
But they all shwarmas.
They all still love each other.
Let me ask you this about Justice League, because you probably know better than I do about this. I saw on IMDb that George Miller was listed as a producer. Now, I know he originally was supposed to do one and
that's
then got taken off. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a bummer because I actually got excited. Like, well, George Miller's involved. Maybe he'll course correct
just
ship.
Yeah, it's contractual,
Darn it.
It's breaking dreams.
One of the flaming guitar players.
So that's
why in the
future you're going to see Zack Snyder's name still on these movies.
Right.
He will not actually necessarily have been doing anything on them. These contractual things.
No, it's going to be like when you know Ryan Murphy hasn't touched an episode of something, you're going to be like, it's very obvious that Zack.
Like the entire OJ.
Right, exactly.
Which is they just put American Crime Story on that show.
Exactly, exactly.
Let's kind of pull the focus back here instead of just looking at Suicide Squad. Just talk about the summer in general. And as I mentioned earlier, there seems to be this general impression that the summer of 2016 has been a very lackluster blockbuster season, partially because box office receipts are down compared to last summer. Mm. But I would point out last summer was record-breaking, so isn't the fact that it's not as good as last summer just a return to the mean, as statisticians say?
But wasn't last summer kind of an outlier over like a series of a couple of bad years in a
row?
Right.
So again, I think maybe it's just
wrong.
Average then.
Wrong,
no, I think it's a little weak. I think it's weak in general. I think they're still making more money than God, but it's not as good as it could be. It's not as good as it's been, and it's largely because this is one of those summers where the lack of quality is reflected in the lack of box office.
But something that I was wondering about is there's two things at play here. One, there's the fact that I think, and just from what I've read, that comic book centric films are niche, which sort of alienates a certain segment of the population. That's one thing. The other thing is that I think people are not watching movies in general. I think just based on the charts I've been reading, the data says that more time is being spent watching other media and not so much going to a theater.
So let me take that winner, and I'm going to throw to the group three different takes that have been used commonly to explain what's been happening this summer.
Okay.
One is that there's too many comic book movies, and that's too niche. Number two, there's too many sequels, and that's the problem.
Yes.
And number three, people simply aren't going to the movies because they're playing Pokemon Go. So let's start let's continue our previous conversation about DC and Marvel. Are there too many comic book movies? Is that part of the problem?
No, it's crazy to even say that. There are six comic book movies this year.
That seems like a lot.
Out of 200-something movies there were last year there were more spy movies released than there are comic book movies this year. So think about that for a minute. Also, Captain America made over $1 billion. Batman Superman is a failure, but it made $900 million. It's a failure in like the terms of big Hollywood.
Right.
So people are coming. Suicide Squad isn't going to end up making what it should, but it's going to still make a lot of money. Deadpool made a gazillion dollars for an R-rated movie. People like these movies. It's just a matter of they have to be good.
That's what I was going to ask, because we have this list of movies here that you haven't read off yet, so I don't know if you want to do that first. But like, I don't see Civil War on here. I don't see Batman vs. Superman on here. I don't. And so is this because maybe the issue might be more that studios aren't as heavy hitting on the summer season as they used to be, because everyone's trying to get that early jump into the early season.
A lot of some of the big films that you mentioned were, that Devin just mentioned, were films that were before the technical summer season.
Yeah. Right. I remember being really surprised how early in the year Civil War was coming out. Because that was the era, you know, we have that winter dump era, which is now starting to turning into like more January and February at the latest.
Yeah.
And like once March hits, and then we also like this year coming out, we still have Doctor Strange coming out this year.
Wow.
We have the new Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them movie, which is going to be a huge moneymaker. I mean,
and then we have Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, so like it feels like there's a lot of
I'm excited.
You might be the only one. But okay.
I could not be less excited.
I've played a lot of those games that I still can't be excited about.
Oh my god!
But I wonder if that's part of it. Like I feel like maybe we're still looking at this old model, but the bigger movies aren't really following that model. It's the same thing as like TV shows where we're not really following the fall to spring season anymore.
Sure.
When you've got your
You know, I think what's interesting is, talking about the sequels, I think this year's sequels represent Hollywood's problem, which is that they greenlight sequels to movies that nobody cared about in the first place.
Yeah.
This is a list of sequels this summer that nobody gave a shit about the last movie. Right. So, of course, nobody cared. So, I mean, it's like, you know, Alice the Looking Glass. That movie made $1 billion 7 years ago, but nobody liked it.
Right. Yeah.
Huntsman Winter's War, that is the most insane movie to make a sequel to.
I know.
It is insane.
I mean, let's also continue this murderer's row here. And thank you to Winter for collecting this, for suffering through IMDb research to collect this. We have Neighbors 2.
Neighbors 2 is good.
It's a good movie.
And people liked it. But
was anyone asking? But was anyone asking for Neighbors 2?
No, not so soon.
Okay. We have the most recent Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Nobody liked the last one.
We have Divergent Allegiant, which I guess is going to go to
They've actually canceled that series and turned it into a TV show. That's how much nobody gives a shit about that.
Horrible.
Yes. London Has Fallen, which will probably be followed by Moscow Has Fallen. And Tokyo Has Fallen.
The box office has fallen.
Really, I thought it's kind of surprisingly disappointing X-Men Apocalypse film, which I thought
didn't make it look like you wanted to see
it. But I don't think people expected it to fail. That's that from my perspective.
Oh, I did. Right. It's a Bryan Singer movie.
Oh.
He's a terrible
filmmaker.
Well,
never mind that.
Yeah.
But I liked X-Men 2. All right. We had Zoolander 2 after, 20 years ago.
So terrible.
The Independence Day 2 film, Ice Age 3.
Ice Age 5.
Jesus Christ!
Ice Age 5? There's been five Ice Ages?
You've made five Ice Ages?
I thought the three seemed weird.
You've made five... No, wait. Hold on. You made five Ice Ages?
You know, this is like...
Running with it.
Is Tug Speedman in them? Because...
obviously Iceman.
They made four Shrek movies. I mean, and they made a fifth one if you count Puss in Boots.
That's fine, but five
Shrek,
Ice Ages?
I would defend... I think the Shrek franchise has held up actually pretty well.
Exactly.
I don't know about
Ice
Age.
I'm saying that animation, like, everything but Pixar tends to just keep making sequels to what does well.
Okay, so for the non-animated sequels, do we have too many sequels, and has that depressed the box office?
They're just bad. There's sequels that nobody wants. I mean, like, that's the thing. You made a sequel to something. Again, Civil War, everybody wanted it, made $1.5 billion. Like, that's the thing. Make a sequel to a movie people actually liked, and you'll do well.
Why don't they, because I'm so far out of the studio system, but why don't these guys get it?
They're terrified.
They're terrified. That's what they're
terrified
of.
Terrified of what?
Losing their job.
So what happens is, let's say, for instance, Independence Day is coming up on its 20th anniversary or whatever. And everybody's like, oh, everybody loves the 90s. Everybody loves Independence Day. Let's do a sequel. Do you have a good idea for it? Not really. Let's just do it. And then they want to do the sequel because they get to say, oh, it didn't do well. It's the brand. It wasn't me. Obviously, the brand wasn't holding up.
Yeah.
And they can still live in Malibu. It's their cheap fear.
And it feels like a lot of times they'll go ahead and just greenlight a movie that, like, or they'll set a date for it. Like, this is when it has to come out.
Right.
And it's like, oh, maybe you could have given it some more time to develop, and then, like, once you know a little more. Like, Independence Day is a great example, because if Will Smith hadn't been filming Suicide Squad and they could have put him in Independence Day 2, it might have done way better.
That's the craziest thing anybody's ever done, is they killed Will Smith off in a web video. Like in a viral web video.
Yeah.
It was unreal.
Spoiler,
it was unreal to me.
They killed him?
Yeah, he died right after the first movie, according to the web, like the viral
campaign.
He
was testing one of the ships and it crashed.
And it died really young.
Is this in the film or is this
they
separate?
Mention it's in the promotional materials they put out. They put like a fake website out that was like the history of Earth since the...
They spend far too much on the marketing, because whoever did that still thinks it's 96 or 94 and McDonald's is going to come around with a toy.
Well, I'll tell you though, like, if the fact that they didn't wait for Will Smith is insane to me. Because
Not
nobody gives a shit about Independence Day without Will Smith.
It's just not shocking.
You don't think Jeff Goldblum can really carry a franchise, a summer franchise film anymore?
Jeff Goldblum, if you look at his franchise numbers, has made billions upon billions of dollars. So maybe.
Yeah.
That's true. He was in the first
and third Jurassic
right,
Park.
Yeah, so. There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, Devin, it seems like your basic argument is if you make better films, people will come.
People will come.
That seems too simplistic.
They won't always
come. Because it sounds too true.
Very often, they'll, you know, really great films, the audience will often ignore. But just solid, good summer movies, people will come see it. Yeah. Like, just solid middle of the road. Like, we're not asking for anything much better than decent.
But, Winter, you think it's also because there's just too much competition and people just don't want to go to the movies.
I really believe in this. I just believe in this. And this is someone who's been watching. I think I was born at the perfect time. I was born in 1980. So I could watch.
You're exactly as old as Harry Potter.
I know. That's why I'm shocked that he's a bad father and not at the same time. 80s was a crazy time. But just to see the rise of the summer movie, it really started picking up speed 80 plus, right?
Yeah, I'm 81, so I had the same kind of feeling.
Yeah, so that's when you were like, as a kid.
It was like Batman was like, when you're like, oh my God, the movies are coming out.
Yeah, you know when movies are coming out. I remember the first time being disappointed by a summer film, and it was Batman Returns. And I was too young to have that disappointment. I was too young. What is that, 12? I was like, this is absolute bullshit. My expectations are so high. And then you're talking about this at the same time as Last Action Hero. I mean, this is just post T2. So I'm just like, my expectations are super duper high. And I feel like since then, post ID4, it's been nothing but just like let down after slow, like it's like a slow bloodletting. I just feel like they're not doing their due diligence in their approach to filmmaking. I'm pointing at everybody. I'm pointing at all of you. Sony, WB, Paramount.
Oh, I thought you meant me.
No,
I do better.
Riley,
New Line, Marvel. I'm not Marvel.
I've been asleep with a switch.
But I'm pointing at everybody. I mean, the one thing that makes me sad is that the Sony emails exposed so much of what actually takes place during the day when you're making a movie. And a lot of it is like Amazoning and talking shit about other people. And I feel like if these people really immerse themselves in the love of filmmaking and film, that they would find things, but they just don't seem to do it. I think about a movie like The Lobster, which was so great and nobody saw, but continued to make money every week until it finally left the theaters. And now it's on VOD. But that's a great movie, but you would never know that it's out there because you've got entire takeovers and banners and billboards and interviews and ET and your premiere is taking over Hollywood. You don't even know that something good is coming out because you're overwhelmed by all this candy.
But I feel like that one's almost more on the studio for putting the movie out when they did, the distributor for The Lobster. Because like it's not like you said, we've known about summer movies as a season since we were kids.
Sure.
Jaws started the summer.
Right. Yeah,
right. Sure.
Jaws. But like for that being a thing.
But Jaws 3D, but go on.
Yeah. and that was the end of disappointment. Yeah,
right.
It feels like the studios have known when that's happening. And so the only time they put a movie out during the summer is when it's like an indie film, like a small thing, is when they think it's going to offset who's going to be seeing what that weekend. Like,
right.
Like they'll put out like a romantic comedy up against an action film to get people who aren't going to want to see. Whereas I think The Lobster is a movie that you really used to only see coming out closer to
October,
Christmas time.
November,
like award season. Like, hey, there's an interesting little film. And I always wonder, like when a movie like that comes out around that time, it's like, I think now, because there's so many of those little indie films, too.
Yeah, like Swiss Army Man came and went. And I feel like Swiss Army Man would have appealed to a lot of young men, I would think, you know? And it just kind of came and went.
Well, look, I love both those movies. I think Swiss Army Man is maybe my number one movie of the year when it all shakes out. The Lobster I love. But I think The Lobster made the money it was going to make. I think it did actually pretty well for what it, because that's a weird movie.
It's a weird
movie. It is not a movie that really goes down the middle. Swiss Army Man is also a pretty weird movie.
Yeah.
And it's really juggling tones in a way that I think it's not really art house and it isn't really mainstream.
Right.
And so I think both those, I mean, I guess I wish Swiss Army Man had done better, but I think The Lobster did really well for what it is. I think that's sort of how that world works now, which is sort of like the little indie movie chugging along. You're trying to find those little moments that you can squeeze them in to get some attention and do the counter programming.
Right.
But it's hard. And the other thing that's really hard is that there are more movies being released now than ever before.
Yeah.
I mean, the New York Times had a policy once upon a time of reviewing every single movie that opened in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do it anymore because there's just
too many movies.
I mean, you see the same phenomenon in music. You see it in the book world.
Yeah.
And this idea that everything's shrinking and everything's consolidating, maybe the companies that are putting this stuff out, there's consolidation there. But there's more product out there than ever before. Yeah, and I think that filtering through that is a huge challenge.
And it isn't just movies anymore. I mean, like, as you mentioned, it's Pokemon Go. It's it's Netflix, Stranger Things. Everybody stays home all weekend to watch that instead of go to the movies. You know, it's, and there's so much, there's so many competing things. It reminds me of the 50s when TV first showed up.
Yeah.
And that was when they introduced widescreen and 3D because they had to figure out, how do we get them out of the fucking house?
Yeah.
This is a big question to throw to everyone. But do we foresee studios making better decisions in any future near future? Or are we going to be having the same discussion next summer?
Some of the rest don't going to have to die.
They've never made, if you go back in history 100 years, they've always been making bad. It's easy to look back at the past and go, they were making great movies.
Because you're cherry picking
the 10 that were great that year. You're missing the 300 that were trash.
But like I read recently, I was doing a thing about Casablanca, and I realized recently that, like, I read about, they didn't even know at the time, like, they had no conception of that movie or concept of that movie being like, oh, this is going to be some great epic movie. It was just one of like 100 movies that were being
made. They started shooting Casablanca without a finished script.
Yeah.
I mean, like, in terms of like how Suicide Squad is screwed up, Casablanca with the greatest movie of all time did not have a finished script when they started shooting. So, I mean,
they fixed it in post.
They did.
Yeah.
We've got to wrap this up. But one last question. We have at least another, technically speaking, one more month left in summer, right? Labor Day is not here yet. Are there any movies left over the next 4 weeks that you are really looking forward to watching? Riley.
Off top of my head, I mean, I don't have the schedule in front of me, but I will say that when I read you say this was the end of the tentpole season, I go, is it? There's something? And then I realize the next movie that I'm really excited about is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is in November. So.
Right.
I think, and then I'm looking forward, I'm really excited about Rogue One, but again, that's not until December, right, so right. I think that's it for me.
I'm looking forward to seeing Pete's Dragon. David Lowery is a really great filmmaker, and he came in and he's doing this Disney movie, and it looks kind of beautiful and sweet, and I'm interested in that. I'm really excited.
Interesting casting, too, by the way.
Really great casting, yeah. I mean, the whole thing's really interesting. I'm really excited for everybody else to see Sausage Party. I'm really excited to see.
You said everyone else, which means you don't want to.
I've seen it. I've already seen it.
Oh, okay.
I'm really excited to see what happens.
Is it good?
I liked it a lot. It's going to probably piss off an enormous number of people. I thought it was very funny. I thought that it has a very sweet message in the end. It's a little crazy. So I'm curious to see. I'm less interested in seeing Sausage Party again.
Yeah.
More curious in seeing how the culture reacts to Sausage Party.
What I'm curious is how many people are going to take their kids, not realizing that it is a wholly inappropriate film.
Oh my God. It is going to be, you know what? I mean,
you can already start writing those stories now.
Yeah, you really can. I mean, like, you know, when I was a kid, I saw people took their kids to see Silent Night, Deadly Night, the Santa Claus serial killer movie. And
God.
I don't know why they did that. They
it's
just saw Santa
so
Claus.
So brutal. And, it was gory even then.
And so I told, that at least was even advertised as a murder movie.
Right.
This, the advertising is like a little.
Yeah.
You
wouldn't know that it's wholly inappropriate unless you've seen, you know, the Red Band trailer or something.
It's unreal how there are things that these pieces of food do to each other that I have never seen depicted on a movie screen in my whole life.
You're now selling it for me.
It is unreal. It is unreal.
Winner, anything left for you for in the next month that you're hyped to see?
I was just scanning, and I will see the Blair Witch sequel. I will see it. I'm hoping that it's going to be good. Everybody says it's good. Have you seen it?
I saw it.
Good.
No.
Okay.
Ooh. He saw it.
Did not enjoy it.
Okay, then it's not going to be good. We have
everybody else likes it, though.
No, but we have like pretty good taste when it comes to horror. Bridget Jones' Baby. Blech, I'm not going to see that. But you know what? Magnificent Seven looks good. That trailer looked on point. And did you see it?
I saw the trailer. I haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, the trailer looks good. What do you think of the trailer?
Wait, when's the movie coming out?
September 23rd.
I'm interested in it. I want to see Denzel and Chris Pratt.
I like them together.
Yeah, I'm really
like it. I like that.
I think the Ben-Hur film's coming out in the next few weeks.
Oh, that's already been...
I have not seen a single thing about it.
I got motion sickness in the theater just watching the trailer.
Okay.
They're already saying that it's... They had to completely shift course marketing-wise. Now they're looking for faith-based audiences. And I'm like, wait, what? Okay.
That sounds like a winning
movie. Well, you have to. Jesus shows up in that movie. It's like... that story, Jesus, is like the main ending of the movie is about Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like... That's a weird movie to remake in this day and age because it is so Jesus-heavy.
Yeah.
But I found in the original, and it's been a long time since I've watched Ben-Hur, all you see of Jesus is like Jesus' foot, and that's about it.
He's nailed
the back of his head.
He's nailed to the cross. So Ben-Hur comes across him.
Oh,
so the journey is Ben-Hur coming to Golgotha and seeing Christ crucified.
I see.
So it's like a big, that's like the whole point of it.
Do you think will that be in the remake as well?
It is.
Okay.
You can see it in the trailer. I mean, it's called Ben-Hur. The book is called Ben-Hur, A Story of the Christ, is the name of the book.
So Christ is in it then.
Is it? He's 100%.
Is it Mel Gibson?
The crisis in it just about as much as the Joker is in Suicide Squad.
Okay.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be back with everyone's jams.
Attention, Europe. This fall, Maximum Fun is bringing a bunch of your favorite podcasters to London. Catch Judge John Hodgman, International Waters, and Bullseye all recording live episodes at the London Podcast Festival. We'll have fan meetups and we'll be joined on stage by a glittering array of celebrity guests. The London Podcast Festival runs September 22nd through 26th, and you can buy your tickets right now. Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum, and sitting with me are...
Riley Silverman,
Devin Faraci,
and Winter Mitchell.
And every week on Pop Rocket, Winter, what do we ask everyone on Pop Rocket every week?
You guys, what's your jam?
Riley, what is your jam this week?
My jam this week is Tegan and Sarah's Boyfriend.
To be honest, cause I can't.
I feel like this was Guy's too. Wasn't this Guy's? Or this was Margaret?
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
That's okay. We are allowed to have recycled jams.
Should I go?
We've been re-jammed!
No, it's just a fun. It's a nice, very queer positive. It's I mean, obviously it's Tegan and Sarah, but yeah, it's basically about her talking to a sort of coming out straight girl who's actually queer and like basically like, oh, you talk to me like I'm like your girlfriend, like friend, but then you also, like, when we're in private, want to fool around, but it's like, I need the whole picture. I can't just be like, this
it's
in this place.
It's really
this
layered.
Place. Yeah, yeah.
Every time I see Tegan and Sarah, I always read it as Reagan and Sarah, and then I think it's about some political ticket. Sorry, that's just my brain working in weird
it's
ways.
Not even how Reagan's spelled.
I know. I'm not saying
Reagan from The Exorcist consistent. Is spelled that way.
Oh,
oh right.
So maybe it's like a dark, weird
there
political
we go.
Ticket.
I
so
like
it's
that.
Trump's ticket. Gotcha. Oh.
Nicely done. Devin, what's your jam this week?
My jam is maybe a little bit different from everybody else's. My jam is from a band called Gloss, Girls Living Outside Society Shit, and it's a song called Give Violence a Chance. And it's from their new EP called Day of Trans Revenge. Gloss is a trans hardcore band, and they really fucking, they're brutal and great.
That's awesome.
And this album, this EP came out, actually, this was not obviously not planned, but it came out the day after the Pulse nightclub shooting. So it sort of ends up, this is a really angry, in terrific hardcore punk fashion, really angry record that kind of hit it at the exact right moment. And this concept of this song, Give Violence a Chance, is obviously the opposite of Give Peace a Chance, and it's the idea that maybe nonviolent protest is a real white middle class concept, and that perhaps, as it says in this song, it isn't that the police are bad; it's that the police are trained to be bad. So it's pretty blistering. I love it. I'm not sure if it's everybody's taste. That's Sadie Switchblade, the lead singer. Incredible pipes. Really, I mean, I understand I've never
like
seen them
it.
Live, but my understanding is that they're really brutal live.
I will go with you if
why
they come to town.
Why couldn't there have been these badass trans punk ladies when I was a teenager? Like, between this and Large and Grace, I'm like, where were you when I needed you? I'm so glad the kids today have you, but I needed you.
Winter, what is your jam?
Mine is Baldwin by Matteo Sinalia. And it's a musical tribute. He's a house musician from L.A. Do you know who he is?
No, I don't.
Oh,
no.
Interesting. I love when I bring you up to new shit.
You do it all the time.
Oh, good. Okay,
I'm disconnected.
Good. He's an L.A.-based house musician, and this is his music under James Baldwin reading his speech, The Artist's Struggle for Integrity.
The first one is... by which I mean all artists, are finally the only people who know the truth about us.
I just like the idea that they played this morning, the first song that Jason Bentley played after the news this morning, and it's like a get up and go and be motivated and make art type shit.
It does sound very KCRW.
It's so...
This is a running joke in our little Pop Rocket squad, just to let our guests in on this. No, it's nice. It's nice. I like, I mean, anything that's a musical tribute to James Baldwin, I'm already
It's so on point.
In.
It's like 7 minutes. It's so on point.
That's great.
Please listen to it.
So for my jam this week, I was I could not join last week's taping because I was on vacation with my family in Kauai, which is my favorite place on the planet. And one of the places that I went was Talk Story Books, which bills itself. This is, it's in a city called or town called Hanapepe, and it bills itself as the westernmost bookstore in the United States. And, and I spoke with the owner at some length, and he double checked to make sure there was not another bookstore in Alaska that could beat it out for this claim.
So, you made him do that.
I did not make him. I just asked, did you verify this claim? And indeed, it is the westernmost bookstore.
Ain't no books in Alaska.
They happen to also stock some records. So, of course, I flipped through them. And given that I was in Hawaii, I feel like I had to pick up something from it. And so I found this Live Lounge album from 1967.
Nice.
It's by an artist named Buddy Foe and his band, his lounge band, Live at the Shell Bar, which was recorded, I believe, live in Waikiki, again, in 1967. And this is their cover of Herbie Hancock's classic Watermelon Man.
There better be some slack guitar in here. I'll be mad.
No. Not that kind of Hawaiian lounge album.
It's good though.
I like it.
It's fun.
I do like it.
The banter. The great thing about lounge albums is just the banter with the crowd in between, and it was just nice to be able to bring like a musical artifact back from a really really nice vacation. But I'm really happy to be back here with all of you. All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted this week by me, Oliver Wang, with Winter Mitchell and our special guests, Riley Silverman and Devin Faraci. Said it right this time,
right? You did.
Right? Yes. All right, so for both of you, where can people get more information on the things that you do, Riley?
Well, right now, the best way to find me is on Twitter. I'm at Rye Silverman, and I have a comedy album called Intimate Apparel. And, of course, as a Max Fun listener, you should be listening to my Max Fun podcast, International Waters, that I am a writer on.
I'm sorry I forgot to mention that.
It's all right. I did now.
Yes, Devin.
You can find me on Twitter at DevinCF, and you can find me on the Earwolf Network at The Canon, and you can find me every single goddamn day writing at birthmoviesdeath.com.
Right. We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links in the episode description of this podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizos. Thank you for letting us use it. Thanks to Your Mom Wears Roller Skates, Bad Moms Are Just Dads, Rocks My Pops, Shh, Maggie, and School Meals That Rock for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. This was an all-star set of 5-star names this week.
I gotta look at them with my own.
Wow, that's awesome.
Bad moms are just dads. Mm. I will rebuke thee. My dad is fucking awesome.
If you haven't already reviewed us, please review us and come up with a clever name and give us 5 stars, because that way we will read your name. And if you've got an opinion that you want to share about this week's topics, you can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Christian Duenos, who's wearing an awesome hat that has the word hat on it. I love that. Very meta. And Colin Anderson. Thank you for joining us.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.